This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual space where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. And this week I want to know why there's been a simultaneous wave of street protests, often leading to bloodshed, in three countries across the Middle East: Iraq, Iran and Lebanon. Something important is going on in the Middle East. We've been preoccupied over here, so you may not have noticed, but the novelty has taken the form of unarmed street protesters in three countries: Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. And in each of them, the protest seems to have badly shaken the authorities. Today, we're asking what lies behind the unrest, how governments are responding, and where it's all heading. Step inside the briefing room for some answers. Let's start with Iran. Now, it's just about impossible for journalists to operate freely there. But on the line from Amman in Jordan, I was joined by Michael Safi, international correspondent for The Guardian, who's been closely following the protests. Michael Safi, what happened in Iran in November?
Well, on November 14, quite late in the evening, the Iranian government went on television and announced that in a few hours, at midnight that evening, the price of petrol would increase, that they were removing subsidies on petrol, which would mean the prices would at least double and possibly triple for some purchases. And so people immediately rushed to petrol stations. They tried to fill up before the price rise went in. Obviously, most were not able to do that, and there was significant unhappiness, and that manifested over the next few days with what we understand to be the largest scale protests in the history of the Iranian regime, and they were met with the deadliest crackdown in 40 years.
So what form did the protest take?
So initially, people would turn their car off in traffic as a way to kind of bring cities to gridlock, to show how unhappy that they were with the increase in petrol. Then over the next hours and days, it morphed into a kind of wider expression of unhappiness with the regime, with the economic situation, the rising cost of living. And initially, we understand, most protests were peaceful, but then grew violent on both sides. And on the government side, there was beating of protesters, the use of tear gas, and ultimately shooting. And we're told that at least 200, probably many more Iranians were killed over the next days.
Where were they killed? Do we know?
According to the Iranian government, the protests spread to 29 of the country's 31 provinces. So this really was something that convulsed the entire country.
What can we say about the kind of people who were protesting?
Certainly there were younger people. There were students who were traditionally the backbone of protest movements in Iran, both before and after the Islamic Revolution. But what makes these protests interesting is that they appear to have involved a lot of working class Iranians, Iranians who belong to ethnic minority groups. Why that's interesting is that working class Iranians are thought to traditionally make up the base of the Iranian regime. I mean, if this was the US, these would be the folks wearing the kind of red Make America Great Again hats. And it was in many places, these folks who were out on the street, unhappy, leading the protests. Whereas in the past, many of these protest movements have been led by the middle class who are unhappy with the lack of civil and political rights.
Now, one of the reactions by the regime was to try and stop almost all contact with the outside world.
That's right. Iran's internet to the world's internet was shut down. Iran connects to the outside world through two main ports. They were shut down. Many other networks that connect were shut down. And so for at least 5 days and a lot longer in many places, Iranians were not able to access any websites that have servers or infrastructure overseas. The Iranian regime has been helped in this process of trying to wall the Iranian internet off from the world, ironically, by American sanctions, because the sanctions that were put in place in the past 18 months have meant that tech services like Amazon, like Google, have had to kick Iranian businesses off of their servers. And so those businesses have had to go back into Iran, which actually makes it easier for the Iranian government to cut the country off from the world without bringing down the internal Iranian intranet.
Did the blackout, effectively, the internet blackout, have the effect of diminishing the protests and stopping them from spreading?
It doesn't appear to have stopped the protests from spreading, but it did make it harder for people inside Iran to communicate with each other. It also made it harder for the world to know what was happening. And so the efforts of journalists like me to cover the protests, that was all made a lot harder. It was only after the internet began to be restored that we all started to receive this rush of videos, of messages, of information from people inside Iran, painting a portrait of what had happened.
Some of which was pretty horrific.
Very much so. I mean, just to sort of scroll through some of the videos I was getting, there were bloodied bodies on the floor, there were people being shot, there were protesters being beaten. And even now, weeks later, we're still sort of struggling to piece a kind of narrative together about what exactly happened.
Now, you say weeks later, essentially, these protests are over.
Yes. As far as the actual intense phase of the mass protests, they are over. There have been small protests since then, but within 3 or 4 days, the Iranian government declared it had defeated these protests, which it said were the responsibility of a kind of foreign power. They were an act of sabotage inside the country. But for the most part, yes, the government was able to defeat them pretty quickly.
Michael Safi on Iran. Now let's turn to Iraq, which neighbours Iran, and Pesha Magid, who is a journalist based in Baghdad. Pesha Magid, tell me about how these protests started.
So the protests first started in the beginning of October. They started broadly over the fact that, you know, the politicians who've been in power for the past 16 years have not been able to provide many Iraqis with basic services. The response to the protests was really, really violent. Snipers were used to shoot down people in the streets. And because of that violence, more and more people became angry at the Iraqi government's not only what they say is failure to act as a proper government, but also their complete suppression of protesters.
What were the protesters initially demanding?
Initially, they were demanding job opportunities. They were demanding better services. People were talking about how they would graduate from university and there'd be zero jobs available for them. They'd only be able to do things like sell tissues in the street. They were angry about the endemic corruption that they saw placed throughout the Iraqi government. But since then, the demands have grown bigger. And now the protesters, almost every single one of them, say they want the resignation of the entire government.
And who are they?
The majority of them are young protesters from the south, so that's majority Shia provinces. But while the majority of the protesters are Shia, the protests themselves are not sectarian, and people have specifically been saying one of the problems that they see with the government is sectarianism and that they want to have a state that is Iraqi regardless of sect. There have been protesters coming in from some of the other provinces in the north, you know, Sunni protesters, Kurdish protesters coming to Baghdad to support and participate in the protests.
And what form do the protests actually take? I mean, do people just suddenly appear on the streets or do they go to main squares? Do they stay there very long?
So the nexus of the protests is Tahrir Square, which is in Baghdad. In Tahrir Square, it's become almost like a miniature city. There are tents set up. There's free food available. People will even do your laundry or give you a haircut. They also have emergency medical services available there for the protesters who are injured in the more violent parts.
What are the ages of the protesters?
They're pretty young. They are usually from around 17 to 30. And many of them are from the generation that kind of grew up in the, you know, post-American invasion of Iraq reality. Many of them say that's part of the reason why they're out protesting is because they grew up with this government that has, you know, utterly failed them for as long as they can remember. People also, you know, are angry because Iraq is an incredibly oil-rich nation, and they see that there's all this wealth collected, but where does it go? Clearly not to any of the services for the people.
How many people have taken part in the protests when they're at their highest?
I mean, it's hard to measure, but I mean, thousands, definitely. They are really big, especially at the beginning, you know, around the 25th of October, there were huge numbers in the streets. Nowadays, there's kind of a central few thousand who stay in Tahrir Square 24/7.
We gather that there's been quite a lot of violent reaction by the government and maybe some others.
Over 420 people have died as of this point, maybe more. Now there have been an entrance by what people think are militia groups who have been, you know, a few days ago, they opened fire on protesters from the back of trucks, kind of firing widely at protesters in Tahrir. And there's also been reports of knife attacks in Tahrir Square.
And who's doing that?
I would say most protesters think that they are Iranian-backed militia groups who want to keep the current government in power.
And do the protesters see the hand of Iran in any of this?
Definitely. I mean, they think that Iranian-backed militia groups are, you know, responsible for many of their deaths. And they look at the political parties that are in power, and many of them are backed by Iran. And there's been some very blatant things like, you know, Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, coming to visit Baghdad, you know, at the beginning of the protest, giving advice on how to crack down on the protests, and in the more recent period, giving advice on who should be selected as the new prime minister, that protesters see as quite blatant meddling. One of the most common chants that you hear throughout the protest is, Iran, get out, get out.
Now, I'm not at all sure that I'd want to protest if people were firing live bullets at me. So is this form of reaction to them beginning to work? Are the protests getting smaller? Are people scared?
No, I mean, no, the protesters have shown remarkable resilience in the face of the violence. What I've heard from people is that they've gotten used to death, and that also they feel like if they don't go out and they don't protest now, this is kind of their last chance. They won't be able to, you know, have a life with dignity unless they go out and they risk their lives.
Pesha Magid on Iraq. And lastly, Lebanon. Journalist Lizzie Porter is in Beirut. Lizzie Porter, how did the protests in Lebanon begin?
Protests in Lebanon started on October 17th. The straw that broke the camel's back was a proposed tax on internet voice calls, so WhatsApp calls, Messenger calls, and people use them a lot in Lebanon because phone calls are very expensive. That proposed tax would have meant, I think it was $6 a month, which doesn't sound very much, but people's living costs had already been squeezed here. So there was this proposed tax rise, which was quickly shelved. But that really, it was a culmination of months and months of economic strife, people seeing their living costs go up and their income squeezed. On top of that, in the summer, there were big forest fires in the Shouf Mountains. They affected the cedar forests, which are really beloved and cherished in Lebanon. The cedar tree is on the Lebanese flag. People really felt that the forests burning were a sign of the state's incompetence, not only because the government couldn't put the forest fires out, they had to rely on helicopters from neighbouring countries, and this was because the Lebanese state helicopters weren't in a position to put the fires out, which meant they raged. So October 17th, hundreds of thousands of people started taking to the streets with chants, demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations for the most part. part. And this happened in Beirut, and protests aren't a new thing in Beirut. There are often protests about government policy, but these protests extended to the whole country in cities like Baalbek in the Bekaa Valley, in Tripoli in the north. There were hundreds of thousands of people in the first couple of weeks. The number's definitely gone down, but roadblocks, big protests outside government buildings, they've been carrying on.
Now, who actually are the protesters and where do they come from?
It's composed of everybody. I think that's really something that's marking out this protest movement. Whereas before, in the mid-2000s, you had big protests that were more or less divided along political party lines, which themselves are sectarian-based. Here, it's really non-sectarian. There's no one leader. There are civil society groups. There are normal people. There are groups from the unions. People aren't saying, oh, it's Sunnis versus Shia Muslims or Christians here. It's very much youth-led. So, and that reflects the population as a whole.
How has the government responded?
So Saad Hariri, the Prime Minister, resigned on October 29th, just a couple of weeks into the protests. So that meant that the government collapsed. Since then, there have been negotiations between the political leaders here to try and find a replacement for him. They've been finding replacements who don't really meet protesters' demands. They are demanding a small cabinet of technocrats who are not affiliated to the existing political parties. They also want a new election law and early elections to be able to vote in people who they do feel are representative of their wants and needs. Mostly the protests have been peaceful and the crackdown by government security forces hasn't been as violent as, for example, as it has been in Iraq. There have been cases of protesters being beaten and arrested by the security forces. But overall, there has been less of a violent crackdown by the security forces. Now, if the economy continues to deteriorate, then that may change.
Lizzie Porter on Lebanon. Now we're up to speed on what's been happening in the three countries. The big question must be whether this unrest might follow a similar path to the Arab uprising or spring, a term for the wave of protests that swept through a number of countries in the Middle East a decade or so ago. Joining me is the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, and Dr. Lina Khatib, head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at the Foreign Policy Institute, Chatham House. Jeremy Bowen, we've heard about the protests in Iraq, Lebanon and Iran, and certain kind of similarities between all three of them, which I suppose you might sum up as the economy, young people being involved, anger about corruption and so on.
Yeah, I think that's all absolutely accurate. They have those features in common. And of course, quite a lot of those were being talked about back in 2011, all of those, as a matter of fact, at the time of the Arab uprisings, the so-called Arab Spring, which I always thought was a misnomer because it's blossoms and new things. And even at the height of say, the uprising in Egypt, where I was every day in Tahrir Square, at no point did I think, as some people were predicting, that it was about to become Sweden or Germany. You know, it was not going to be like that. It was always going to be difficult. And the people with power were never going to want to give it up. But yes, there are characteristics which, while every country involved in these uprisings has its own particular local reasons for anger, there are some things in common. And those are the ones that you mentioned, I think, are the biggest.
Lina Khatib, one aspect which seems to be interesting is the demographics of the Middle East, just the age of the population and the inability of the systems to deliver what people want.
Yes, absolutely. You have populations with a majority of youth ruled by people who are often very old in their 70s or 80s. I mean, the president of Lebanon, for example, is in his 80s. And they are disconnected from how the young generation came to formulate their worldviews. In Iraq, in Lebanon, and other places, the new generation has grown up connected to the outside world through the internet. And they can see that there is another way to live. And they are looking at their circumstances as being something they should try to change because they can see there is another way. Now, how to get there is another story.
One aspect of this, Jeremy, it seems to be a movement away from, if you like, the kind of sectarian structures of some of these countries, or at least something of a rejection of it.
Well, yeah, Iraq and Lebanon are highly sectarian societies. The entire political system is based around sectarianism. And what's more, it doesn't deliver. I was in Beirut last week and a lot of younger people were saying we don't want this old sectarian way of doing things. But that's the system. And the question, which none of them could answer when I posed it, was how do you go to the next level then? It's one thing standing in the street. How do you actually change this whole system in the way that you want when what would be required would be so absolutely fundamental?
What would be required then?
Well, if you look at the way that, say, the political system is in Lebanon, the main sectarian groups have jobs reserved for them in the government. You know, for example, the president's always a Maronite Christian. Prime minister's always a Sunni Muslim.
Lina Khati, what do you think?
I think what the protests in Lebanon are showing is that Lebanon is the society that's divided between those who still believe in sectarianism, and these tend to be the followers of the political parties that are in power, as well as Lebanon's current leaders, and then a significant proportion of society that is rejecting this system and actually saying we need to implement the Lebanese constitution. Because after the Taif agreement that ended the Lebanese civil war,
back in 1990,
at that time, the constitution that was agreed on says that Lebanon should work towards having parliamentary elections that are not based on sectarian allocation of political seats, of seats for people in parliament, and that instead leaders of religious sects should form a kind of House of Lords, an upper house. But that was never implemented. And so what the protesters are now saying is that we just need the constitution to be implemented. Now, maybe, Jeremy, I don't know, while you were on the street, perhaps not everyone is fully aware of that in terms of the younger protesters.
Most of the people I was talking to weren't even born then.
Yeah, exactly. But it does exist. And therefore, there is actually a clear path forward.
Well, let's switch over to Iraq now. Lina Khatib, as I remember it, after 2003 and the American-led invasion of Iraq, there's quite a lot of hope that there might be a growth of secular parties. Do the protests give any hope now that such a secularism might finally appear?
Well, right now in Iraq, the demonstrations are not about religion. They are about issues. And this means that the ground for having a secular party is already there. Plus, last year during the election, Iraq witnessed in the parliamentary election an alliance between one of the groups, that is a Shia political party led by Muqtada al-Sadr, and the Communist Party. The fact that people voted for that coalition last year tells us something. The problem is that the current political system is so entrenched and so resistant to change that it is trying to stop any attempt at having this vision happen.
And it's so militarized as well. There are numbers of militias who are powerful, who are linked to prominent men, and who are also, most importantly, linked to Iran. And the Iranians essentially hatched the deal which put the current departing prime minister into power. And the Iranians, for Iran, Iraq is a very important country.
Which takes us neatly to Iran itself, because whilst the protests in Iraq and Lebanon appear to be still going on, Jeremy, those in Iran seem on the face of it to have finished.
Well, it's, you know, hard to tell because we can't get in there. And, you know, at the height of them, the authorities switched off the internet. So I don't know if they were hoping that news wouldn't leak out. Of course, it would eventually. The regime in Iran is very good, it seems, at, you know, crushing protest. But one thing that is interesting is that they used a degree of violence in crushing these that they didn't use, say, in 2009, when there were hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Tehran protesting about what they believed was a stolen election.
Well, that brings me to the question about what it is that authorities may have learned from previous protests and indeed from the Arab Spring. Is one of the things that Iran is teaching the world is that repression works.
Unfortunately, I mean, this was something that Iran tested in 2009 and then 2 years later explored the same method in Syria through advising the Syrian regime at the time on how to crush protests. And now we're seeing the same thing deployed in Iraq as well. We have to remember the pro-Iran militias are playing a huge role in the violence against protesters in Iraq. So it's not surprising that this model of sheer violence is also applied at home in Iran itself.
Yeah, if you're a regime prepared to spill enough blood, violence tends to work. Violence, terror, locking people up, torturing them, executing them, shooting them dead on the street. You know, it scares people and they stay home until they come out again.
Until they come out again. We'll come on to that in a moment. Now, of course, the mechanisms that are available to a government like that of Iran is not really necessarily the same as the mechanisms that might be available to the government of Lebanon.
In Lebanon, it's a bit more difficult. We are seeing a fraction of the violence that's currently witnessed in Iran or Iraq against the protesters. One person was shot by the security forces. But it's a bit more difficult in Lebanon because Iran doesn't have absolute authority in Lebanon like it does in its own home in Iran itself, but even in Iraq.
Now, presumably, though they can crack down, none of the governments involved, none of the authorities involved love this kind of protest. And presumably, if they could, they'd also like to palliate some of it. Is there anything that the governments can do, Jeremy, practically, to make such protests less likely, to make protesters feel better?
You can always try and make people happier if they're unhappy by putting some money in their pockets, if you've got it. But Iran is in deep economic trouble. Iraq is, a potentially rich country, but it's very badly managed. And in all the indices of corruption around the world, it's normally ranking somewhere in the top five. So a lot of that money in Iraq disappears. And there's also a very serious economic crisis in Lebanon. So the money isn't there to try and pay people off, to make them feel a little bit happier about their lot by giving them easier lives.
So that kind of leaves repression as your major governmental option.
That's not so much the case in Lebanon, but Iraq is a country which is suffused with violence and killing over many, many years. In areas of the country, say for young men, many of whom don't have jobs, about the only job they can get is to carry a gun for someone. So there are real problems in a country like that where violence has, for some people, sadly, almost become second nature.
Lina Khatib, what about other countries in the region? Are there potential protesters watching all this happening, thinking, well, maybe we should do the same? Or are they looking at it thinking, no, I won't go for that?
What's interesting is that the protesters in Lebanon and in Iraq rose up having witnessed for almost a decade the wars raging in places like Libya or Syria. Despite seeing the kind of gloomy scenarios in those places, the protesters in Lebanon and Iraq were not deterred. And in fact, they learned from them that the best thing you can do is stick to peaceful demonstrations, no matter how much violence is inflicted upon you. The Iraqis are not going back home, even though they are being killed in large numbers. And I think other people in the Middle East region, they're witnessing what is happening with this wave of protests and perhaps planning for something in the future.
Finally, I suppose this may seem quite an irritating question to those of you who specialise in Middle Eastern affairs, but is there anything that Western governments like Britain and America should or could do to assist?
The protesters in Lebanon are saying we do not want Western help. And that's because Western so-called help over the past few years, since, for example, the days of Obama, when he would say the right things and not do any of the right things, have basically led people to be very cynical about the intentions of the West, even if the West says we're going to help you. I think what Western countries can do at best is in their engagement with the existing governments in those regions to just have conditionality linked to this engagement so that any aid, whether military aid or humanitarian aid or any kind of government support, is not given just blindly. It should be linked with reform requests. It should be linked with clauses about good governance. But this is about it. I don't think the protesters want or need anyone to actually come and give them leadership courses or give them civil society grants.
Lina Khatib there with Jeremy Bowen. To sum all that up, these countries, run by old religious sectarians, have young populations with demands that their creaking economies and corrupt establishments just can't meet. And this wave of protests may die down, but another, possibly bigger, is likely to follow. My thanks to Michael Safi, Pesha Magid, Lizzie Porter, Dr. Lina Khatib and Jeremy Bowen. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Serena Tarling and Rosamund Jones. The editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoy this podcast, you'll probably like some of our other episodes, including ones on post-election taxes, meat-eating and Brexit. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.